Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Your Intention Matters. Thanks very much for joining. My name, of course, is still Paul Madat. Today, I have Chris Krasinkovich, VP Sales of Canada, coming to us from Chris. Our generation, I think, calls it the T-Dot in Toronto, but the next generation knows it as the Six. How are things?
Pretty good, Paul. Pretty good. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, you bet. Hey, listen, how'd I do on the last name?
Really good. I'm impressed.
All right, I can stay. All right. Good man. Well, listen, do me a favor, say hi to everybody, provide a quick intro, and then we'll jump into your story.
Hello, folks. My name's Chris Krasinkovich. I work for a company called UKG, and very pleased to be here.
Married, father, both, neither?
Oh, I am married second time. So live in the blended family, three boys, three girls. So you could call us the Brady Bunch.
Nice.
So the boys are all older and the girls are younger, and there's always something going on in the household or in our lives.
Nice. And so you've put chickens and ducks together.
Oh boy.
Just like I went through. I love it. Well, listen,
it's worked out well.
That's great. I love to hear that. And so, Chris, I appreciate you being here. Sincerely, I know you're stretched pretty thin in the role that you're in right now. And so we've been talking about the podcast before I hit record, and you have a decent understanding of the foundation, and that is your intention matters. And it's built on really my own mindset that nothing is really given to any of us, and you can't really ride people's coattails. And most of us in the world of sales never thought we'd even really get into it, quite frankly, let alone even sustain a career. And I mean, there's no sales school, really. There's no degree in sales. And yet
nobody grows up thinking they're going to be in sales when they're in school or grade school.
Yeah, totally. Like I just talked to my son this morning. We're talking to you about him. He's 6 years old. I said, what do you want to do? And he goes, I want to play the piano. Great. So maybe he'll be a pianist. Who knows? But there's no, I want to be a salesperson. Right. Sure. And so it's a conversational podcast about how you got to current state. And I'm looking forward to you sharing your story because you've had a wild ride here. So you ready to go?
Sure. Let's go.
All right, good. So we go back in time on this podcast. Let's go back to Laurier, late 80s. I think you graduated with a degree in business, if I have that right from what I can see in your LinkedIn profile. And so, Chris, if we go back to that time, were you like most of us where you didn't really have much of a sense as to what you thought you'd be doing? You got your degree and you were going to figure it out. Or did you have some sort of a vision for what you thought you might want to do as you were getting ready to get out there?
I'll take you back a little further, Paul. In high school, here's how the decision framework went. I don't like chemistry. I don't like physics. I did well in those, but I wanted to avoid being an engineer where I'd have to apply those. But I love math. And so I thought, where can I go to apply my math? And, you know, I didn't want to be a professor. So it was business. And so I looked at the business schools, and Laurier at that time had a co-op program. And so I thought, hey, great. I paid for my own way through university. So nothing was given to me until after university. And we'll come to that part of the story. But I paid my own way through school because fortunately enough, I got into the co-op program. And I hooked up with IBM at the time. They were one of the premier companies coming onto campus. P&G was the other one. I didn't want to get into consumer packaged goods. Thank God I didn't do that. And, you know, the financial sphere was an interesting place to go, you know, being a financial advisor. But I really liked the idea of getting into high tech at the time. And so I chose IBM as my number one. After interviews on campus, and they chose me as number one. And so fortunately enough, I had three work terms with IBM, and I loved my Laurier experience. It was a small school, and I had a choice at the time. I had either Western or Laurier, and I chose, I got some good advice from a guy in high school, Andy Dingman. And he said, do you want to be a number, or do you want to really get to know the people on campus? And I'm one of those people that I like getting to know people, like getting to the personal side of things. So at the end of the day, I chose Laurier because of that. And it was a brilliant decision because I have lifelong friends from there, Paul, that I've known for 30 plus years now, and we play poker together and we celebrate things together. And it's been a brilliant decision.
Well, I can appreciate you saying that. You know, I mean, I went to York in Toronto and it was like 50,000 students. And, you know, I mean, I certainly could have made a more concerted effort to get involved a little bit more with the school community, but for whatever reason, I didn't do it. But I can appreciate what you saying, going to Laurier, which probably had maybe 10 to 15,000 students versus 50,000 at Western. Correct. And so you can get a little bit more ingrained. And
it was even smaller than that because the co-op program was 500 or so.
Oh.
So you really got the opportunity to know each other. And then the peste de resistance was, I actually had to go to school during the summer because of how my work terms worked. You would go to school 4 months, then work term for 4 months, and then go to school. And I had two summer work terms. And those summer terms at school at Laurier were my best terms. Like, we had such a great social life, and the professors were relaxed, and I learned a lot.
And so did I catch this right, Chris, that your co-op experience was actually with IBM?
It was.
Okay. Yeah. And so when you eventually graduated, did you stay with IBM? Did they have a glide path for you?
Well, actually, it turned out that for the first time in their history, they had a hiring freeze on when I was eligible to be hired.
No.
And so they said to me, Chris, unfortunately, you have to go fend for yourself. Now, I was so disappointed, Paula. But I ended up getting a job with Stelco, if you remember Stelco.
I'm drawing a blank.
Big steel company in Hamilton. DeFasco was the second one. And so Stelco hired me and they put me into their executive program. I thought, wow, big deal, right?
Did you move to the Hammer? Did you move to the Hammer?
I did.
Nice.
2 months later, IBM calls up and says, hey, our hiring freeze has dropped.
Oh.
We have one or two openings for people. Would you like to be one of them? And so I looked at it and I went, Hamilton or Toronto? Steel or high tech?
Right.
So there was a little bit of short-term pain in that because I had committed to an apartment lease. So I had to pay financially to get out of that. But it was a great decision long-term. Ended up moving to Toronto and sleeping on a couch with friends and starting my career at IBM.
And so what was your first opportunity with IBM? Were you in sales?
I was, but they made me a pre-sales technical rep at first so that I'd learn about the solutions without worrying about selling. And so I did that for about 6 months to half a year, 6 months to 9 months. And then I went into being a sales trainee. And at that time, you had to go through a lot of IBM schooling to learn about the product line. So there was a year of that. And then I've got my first territory. And that's the blessing, Paul, of back 30 years ago. I mean, right now the sales forces of the world make you, you're a business development rep, and then you get a really small territory, and then you get a little bit larger, then a little larger, then a little, and you take 2, 3, 4 years to get to the point where I did in 1 year, right? I had my full-fledged territory, and I was so grateful for that. I made my mistakes, but I also got to learn in a super fast way because of the opportunities that were ahead of me.
You know, so my background and my foundation is from Xerox. And so I'm a little bit biased when I say this, but I know Xerox to be an amazing company for providing a terrific platform for development of their people. And I know IBM is always considered like one in two with Xerox in terms of
it was 100%
the place to go. It wasn't even a question about it. And so how long was your tenure with IBM?
It was 11 years, 10 to 11 years. Okay. And I stayed probably a year to two too long because
all right, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about that because IBM, Big Blue, blue chip company, massive organization. There had to have been lots of growth opportunities for you. And I'm assuming that in your 11 years there, you probably had multiple roles in that time for different experiences and so on. So talk to me about the decision to move on, because how do you leave a giant like that with lots of additional opportunity? Like, why do that?
That was a fundamental choice. Do I stay and be comfortable for the rest of my life because I could be, or do I go and try something out in the big wide world? Because IBM was a microcosm within itself, Paul, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was promoted very quickly out of being a rep. 3 to 4 years later, I was the youngest sales manager in IBM Canada at the time when I was promoted to a sales management role. I always knew I was going to get into leadership just based on my past. So I had one promotion, then another promotion, and things were going well. And I had the opportunity to become a general manager within the business. And I took a look at those people, and basically the general managers in that business were, they moved shelves around. They really didn't go out and meet customers. They didn't really, you know, invest in the market. They were insular. So they moved shelves around and negotiated things internally within IBM to get to their numbers versus, you know, making a difference up there. And I looked at that and I went, not really what I aspire to. And so I made the jump, and it was fundamental. It was, you know, comfort or adventure.
Now, you say that you were there maybe a year longer than you probably
year to two.
Year to two. That's a long time for you to be kind of noodling it.
Yeah.
To actually make the decision. So the company that you went to, did they find you eventually? Did you kind of raise your hand and find them? Like, what was that process like?
Yeah. So I didn't have a mentor at IBM. So I'm going to highlight that first, Paul. And that's important. If you don't have sponsorship within an organization like that, you're going to have a really hard time. Doesn't matter how good you are. I stayed a year to two too long. And if you recall back then, the year 2000, there was a wall that everybody was going to hit.
Totally.
So I should have left in 97, 98, popped in the software, made a whole bunch of money because everybody did, because, you know, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt out there around the year 2000. I didn't do that. But I did have a company come to me, Origin, Atos Origin is who they're called now, but they came to me and they basically offered me 50% more salary and a pretty good job. And so I made the jump.
Nice. And was it a good move for you?
No, because what I had at IBM that I didn't know was I did have good leadership. I did have good people that I was learning from. And when I went to Origin, it was lacking, and it was unfortunate. They were good people, but it wasn't what I had. And so very quickly within a year, I determined that this wasn't a place for me long-term. And what had been represented to me, the account that I was taking over at the time, Nortel Networks, they told me that they were happy with Origin. When I started working there, what I found out was that I had a recovery job, not a growth job. And so a lot of ergs of energy were put into helping recover the relationship versus grow the relationship. And a few years after that, Nortel imploded. So I was pretty lucky I got out. And fortunately enough, I hooked up with a gentleman at a company named Siebel. He had been my manager at IBM. He had moved over to Siebel. And Siebel at the time was a marketplace darling in customer relationship management. And I had a fantastic 3.5 year run there, found a couple of pots of gold, was able to do a lot of things personally. You know, it was very rewarding. But I basically sold myself out of a job, Paul. Because I was looking after the pharmaceutical market space at the time.
Okay.
And we pretty well sold every single pharma, myself and a small boutique organization that I worked with, and a product manager who was fantastic. The three of us, that triangle, basically we sold every pharma in 3.5 years, and I sold myself out of a job. There was no other market to sell into at that point in the pharma space in Canada.
And so where did you go?
So I was packaged out of the business.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Yeah. And I ended up popping over to Microsoft because Microsoft was growing their CRM practice. And I thought, hey, little
company called Microsoft,
go into something at the ground floor and grow it. Right. The unfortunate thing with Microsoft is if you're not part of the inner circle, it takes years and years and years to earn the trust. And again, I figured that out quickly in about a year. And I said, you know what? I got to pull the plug on this one. And I landed at a company called Intermec. And once again, I'm so grateful because my career accelerated again after that, because I went in as a general manager, as a director of sales in that business, looking over a group of 20 people, both channel and direct salespeople. And also had inside sales and those responsibilities. But very quickly went from being director of sales to general manager of that business to global distribution VP. So I had a global role at that point. So within a short 5 years, I was able to proceed through my career and take on some huge responsibilities I never would have foreseen. And it was all because of a guy named Mike Wills. He was a great, great leader that I worked for in those 5 years. He had tons of trust for me. I was very transparent with him around information. My philosophy, Paul, was always give him more information than he asks for.
Mm.
And when you do that, people they develop a ton of trust in you. And so my reviews with him on a quarterly basis became shorter versus longer because he knew I had everything in control.
You know, Chris, I want to ask you something about your life after IBM. You know, so right now it's March 9th, we're recording this, and we're coming up on almost 20 years to the day for me where I got packaged off. It was April 10th, 2002. And it turned out to be like the best day of my career because it got me into sales. I was in finance. I was kind of behind a desk and not really loving it, but I got packaged off. But at the time, it was not the best day of my career. It was, I got this check here, but how much money do I have? What am I going to do next? How long is this going to take? And that was just me. I was single. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have any real property. It was just, I was still living at home. I was like 27 or whatever. And that was like a gut-wrenching moment for me. So I'm curious if my math is right with your intro. You would have been married at the time when this was going on, when you left and you realized, okay, this wasn't really for me. And then you get packaged off years later. And then now you got to figure, well, what am I going to do with this? You're probably a dad at the time. And so I hate to use the term any sleepless nights, but any like moments of like, I got a ton of responsibility here in my life. I got to figure this out.
Okay. Let's order a beer and let's have this conversation. Right. So the first time it happened after Siebel, you're correct. Married, one child, 2-3 years old. And it was dramatic. The impact on my psyche was, pretty significant, right? Even though I could see the picture being drawn on the wall, because we had sold out pretty well everything. We knew where the next deal was and it was 2 years out. So it was a 6 month period that was really difficult. But the thing is you always land on your feet.
Yeah.
You always end up getting something. And that's what I've grown to realize over time is not to worry about that, but it happens to the best of us. And so I look at it and I say that 6 month period was tough, but after Intermec, so there's a second story like that, Paul, because it happened to me a second time because Mike Wills got tired of the organization and left. And I was left without a sponsor at that point. And the gentleman that came in said, hey, Chris is the only executive outside of Seattle because that's where our headquarters was. Put a bullet in Chris and bring that role into Seattle. And so at Intermec, I had the same thing happen to me and it was a 9 month period. But what also happened at the same time is I went through a divorce. So a divorce was announced in August. In September, I was let go of my job. So now, the way I describe it, Paul, is I thought I had the perfect life, perfect wife, perfect neighborhood, perfect job. And God basically kicked the milk crate out from under me. I landed with a thud and all the air was knocked out of me, is the way that I speak about it. And I went into a dark black hole for 6-7 months because I stared into the abyss, Paul, and the abyss was staring back at me. And I had to make some fundamental decisions about me and what was important to me and life. And at the time I had 3 children, 2 dogs, you know, and all of that was being blown up. So I was no longer a VP. I was no longer a father of a family. I was no longer what I had put up as titles. And what's really interesting there, Paul, is I went from a hierarchical value system in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the most important thing. This is second, this is third, this is fourth, to a circular framework for my life. So in the middle, I put God. Second thing, me. Third thing, my partner. Fourth thing, my family. Fifth circle. And so anytime anything bad happens to me now, I can go back into the middle of the circle and work my way out to manage any difficulties in my life. And that is probably the most powerful thing that I have ever discovered in my life. And that happened at the age of 45. I thought I was so smart, but
right.
It came from, Paul, the way I deal with problems is that I read. I read 60 books in about 3-4 months. They were about relationships. They were about health. They were about spirituality. They were about business. They're about a whole bunch of different topics, but I was able to take all of that knowledge and come up with a path forward. And I'm so grateful for that period. Like I'm so grateful for it.
Now,
because it's in that suffering that you grow the most,
right? Like,
suffering creates growth. I so firmly believe in that. And, you know, a few months later, I would say, you know, if August was, you know, when I was separated, divorced, in May of that next year, I met my partner, my love of my life, my kindred spirit, she's a wonderful, wonderful partner. And I grew to appreciate what unconditional love is all about versus conditional. And I'll kind of stop there because now we're going into a really, you know.
No, I appreciate the dialogue.
Area. I'm a pop psychologist at heart and I'm very spiritual. And so those things come out in discussions.
No, this is a great conversation. And so give me some context for us, the timeline, late 2000s, 2010. Now, where are we at here?
2010.
So 2010 is when this goes down. And for anybody who can really remember, you know, was working at the time, 2007, 2008, like it wasn't really that great. 2009, we were still kind of coming out of the mortgage crisis. And it's not as if there was an abundance of jobs out there. And then you find yourself managing
for 9 months out of work,
like a personal, you know, scenario, which is like life altering. And then, you, of course, you found yourself in a professional scenario where it's like, well, now I got to find something. And so the 9 months, you come out of it. Where did you land?
Well, here's the thing, Paul, like I'm going through a legal process with these companies because they tried to give me 2 weeks compensation like they do in the US. And we were saying, no, this is Canada. And that happened with Siebel and it happened with Intermac. And so those companies paid off. But until we did come to an agreement, I didn't have anything coming in. And remember, I had family.
Right.
And so, you know, drawing on savings to make it work. But, you know, I'm one of these people that lives one level below my means and I'm a saver. So, you know, we were able to weather that, but my God, the mental gymnastics that I went through over those 9 months and the fear of not getting a good job, it was incredible.
I have no doubt, especially the unknown of, okay, well, what's next and where do I land? Because change brings so many variables to it. And, you know, you've experienced this 2 or 3 times now since IBM. And so you weathered the storm. And so where'd you go?
I went to a small company because I said, you know, I think I want to try a really small organization. I've had the corporate, I've then had the billion-dollar, you know, gazelle, right, which was what Siebel was. And then I had another billion-dollar organization in Intermec, specialty organization. And I said, why don't I try something that's like $15 million business? Because I always wanted to try that.
Okay.
And so I landed with a company called Digital Rapids. The team there had taken a business and grown it from zero to like 150 million, sorry, and sold it, and it had been really lucrative for them. And so they were doing it a second time.
Mm.
And so I came in there as VP of global sales. And again, found out that if you're not part of the inner circle, it doesn't matter how smart you are, how good your ideas are, how collaborative you are. If you're not part of that inner circle, that's problematic, because people go around your back to the owner to get things done. And so at some point, a year into that, you know, we both looked at each other, the owner and I, and said, this isn't working out for either one of us, because he didn't want to give up any decision-making, whether it was the most strategic marketplace decision, and I was at the table for those, or it was a computer for somebody. Which computer is somebody going to get? A new hire.
Oh.
Like, he didn't want to give up any
of that. That's tough, man.
So, you know, I kind of looked at it and I went, is this going to get better? And it wasn't. He wanted to do everything. And so, great guy. Love the guy. But it was time to move on. And so we came to an agreement. And it's so funny, because every time I've always had these one-year stints where I realized it was wrong, and I decided to get out. I decided to act. And that's when I landed at Salesforce.
How long were you between Salesforce and this company?
A month at most.
All right. So, Chris, let me ask you this, and there's people listening or watching this who are probably questioning, Chris, why not look for a job while you're unhappy and then leave once you get a job? Why would you leave without a job?
You could do that.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm saying people are listening wondering, like, isn't the easier path just to stay there, keep looking, and then go somewhere else?
No, but when I'm working somewhere, I put my whole being into it.
I love that.
Because the problem with not doing that is you're not being genuine to yourself and trying your hardest and putting, you know, what you can into being successful. So that's just the way I am. And fortunately enough, I knew where I wanted to go, because I had enjoyed the CRM space at Siebel, and I wanted to replay it again. And there were a couple of places to go, but Salesforce was the best. It was a quick interview with the guy at the time, Rich. We both looked at each other and we said, this is a really good fit for both of us. I had management experience. He needed a manager. I had CRM experience. I had CRM, and it was a darling at the time. So I jumped in there, and it was a great 5.5 year run.
So Salesforce back in 2011, if I have my math right, is not the company that they are today, of course, but they also were no longer a startup at the time either. And so you kind of got back into maybe not quite an IBM, but you were on the cusp of something pretty cool here. And so talk to me about that.
Yeah. So basically it was an entrepreneurial organization, Paul, where everybody would roll up their sleeves to help each other.
Right.
Like that culture was wonderful, and they knew they had something really good in the product and the solution, and they were hiring the best people. Holy smoke. Like, I have to watch what I say here, depending on who sees this, but working with smart people, I've always enjoyed that. And I've had some instances where I haven't in my career. And it becomes so obvious. And working with B and C players, they're good people.
Yeah.
But you don't get the traction that you really need. So I was at Salesforce now, working with some brilliant people, hiring the best. And we basically tripled our growth in the period that I was there, tripled our revenue, grew out the organization three times. Like, it was massive, massive growth. And it was so much fun for the first 2-3 years. But then Keith, I guess, forget his last name now. He was the global vice president at Oracle. Keith, I want to say Flood, but I know that's wrong.
Let's go with Flood.
But anyway, Keith was brought over from Oracle to Salesforce to lead global sales. And he brought all of his Oracle henchmen with him. And basically, they created a Oracle 2, a mini-me of Oracle. And they created a ceiling for all the people that had grown the business to that point. They kept hitting the ceiling because they weren't Oracle people. And so a whole bunch of people started leaving. And then that's when you knew that there was a shelf life on Salesforce. I knew that, you know, I could probably take two or three more years because it was becoming a culture of mistrust.
Right.
And misinformation. People were forecasting $500,000 deals, even though the customer the day before had said, there's no way we're doing it this quarter. They were still forecasting it because of the fear of telling the truth in the forecast.
That's right. That's a really rough environment to be in. Do you know Colin Nanka?
Well, it's just not me. I'm all about the truth. So I felt very foreign in that environment, right? Colin, yeah. I don't know. No, I don't know Colin.
I was going to say Colin, I've known for years, worked at Xerox. He was like employee number 3 or 4 at Salesforce Canada and right. Just having a great ride with the company. But he joined much earlier than you did, but was talking about the culture was amazing. And right. He's now in New York now and still doing it and still loving where he's working. But that must have been another tough scenario for you. I mean, Chris, did you then, given your own mindset around, if I'm not 100% into this, I've got to let go. Did you electively leave or did you hang on and wait till?
So it was Keith Block, by the way.
Block.
And I do have to credit him because he was brought in because he had to grow the channel, grow the company so they could do bigger, more massive deals. Industry segment the organization, which he had done at Oracle very, very aptly. And he did it again at Salesforce. And Salesforce has been like on a massive growth path even after I left. So
yeah, huge.
I have to give him credit because he did what he was supposed to. But those things that I didn't like, unfortunately, again, you could tell that there was a shelf life here. And so it became obvious between me and my hiring manager after 5.5 years that things weren't gonna work out for me long term there. And fortunately enough, I started interviewing the last month or two, and they gave me the permission to do that. And I found the place that I'm working at right now, which was Kronos at the time. And so again, I was on this wicked trajectory through Kronos and the growth that we've had here. And Kronos became UKG through a merger 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I've been so lucky every time, you know, I've had to pop into something else. It became something even better for me in my life and my career. So I don't know what to say other than be really careful about knowing yourself and what you need and where you need to go next. And trust in the fact that when change happens, a lot of times it's going to be for the positive and for the better. So don't be afraid to make decisions.
I love it. Chris, this has been such a great conversation. I mean, you've packed so much in here into like 40 minutes or so. It's amazing. So I like to recap. Let me see what
I can do. You ask the questions. So you get the credit.
Yeah, but I don't have the answers though. So let's go back. All right. So here's my summary of your story. You went to Laurier to get more of an intimate experience versus a massive school like Western. You chose business because it was a process of elimination of what you didn't want to do.
Things I didn't like.
I'm not doing physics. I'm not doing chemistry. So I love math. Let's go to business.
You can make decisions that way.
You find the co-op program. IBM brings you in. Unfortunately, you find yourself in a hiring freeze. You go to the hammer for a little bit. IBM says, hey, we want you back. You make a decision because it cost you some dough at the time because you had a rent commitment.
Short-term pain, long-term gain.
You go to IBM, have a great ride there 10 years, and then you kind of move on. And then you bounce around a little bit here and there. You go through a personal crisis where your marriage comes to an end, and that's a massive paradigm shift. a month later, you find yourself out of work. You go into a bit of a black hole, as you talked about, for an extended period of time. You come out of it. You work at Oracle. You work at Microsoft. You're at Intermac for a long run. You find Salesforce.com. Again, you bet on yourself and you find Kronos, now UKG. And I got to say, man, just much respect for your overall outlook and what you've been able to create, because it has been anything but just smooth waters all the way. Because some people will see like a LinkedIn profile and they'll see, oh, what a run here. But they don't really know that it wasn't always just puppy dogs and ice cream.
It's not always positive.
Yeah.
It's not. And you have to make a quick decision and pivot. And when you do that, the chances of something good happening are high when you know yourself and you aim for what you want to accomplish, right?
Chris, last question for you. You know, we're recording this kind of in as we move into Q2 of 2022. So it's hardly a new topic, but how did you guys manage the last couple of years with COVID? Like, was your business already virtual? Did that was a new thing for you? How did you battle that?
Yeah. Just like everybody else, we weren't sure that online was going to work, but you didn't have a choice. And so that accelerated things for us. And I'll tell you, there's two things that I'm really grateful for. One is that our solution really helped during COVID. So we were a popular organization to come and talk to try and help organizations deal with the challenges of COVID. The second thing is the productivity that we gained from everybody being at home and not being on planes, not driving cars to calls, being able to jam up their meetings and be more productive in the day, drove significant growth. And it's almost to the point, Paul, where you feel guilty. You feel guilty that things are going so well and gone so well. And again, it's not unicorns, puppies, and because in that time, we were also going through a merger. So we merged with a company right when COVID started. And the two cultures are water and oil.
Mm.
And so we've had to deal with that underneath all of it, right? And credit to the quality of the people that I work with, that we've been able to patiently, you know, bite our tongues, do the right things, drive the growth, have success. Because without that, it would be a lot harder working through the merger.
I have no doubt. Yeah. Well, that's great to hear. And I
answer your question.
Yeah, totally. And I've had the privilege of working with you, but I wasn't sure about, you know, how the setup was, because I've only ever known you recording it this way and working with you this way. Like, we've actually never even met each other face to face, but I wasn't sure, you know, what the environment was like before. And I appreciate your comment around the fact that there is maybe some guilt of, like, we've actually flourished during this time when so many have not.
To think, and so, to have a job, first of all, is one thing. To work with quality people that are caring and ask how you're doing, and you do the same for them daily, weekly, monthly. To have a leader like Aaron Ains, who truly, truly cares and shows that, Chris Todd included, like, you could see people come to the fore during difficult times and really... I'm a business student, so I was watching them, how they were acting, to learn from them, right? And they were right on point. So it was a really good experience from that perspective. But again, there's a guilt that goes with that, and
I get it.
You have to compartmentalize that, right?
Well, Chris, man, as I said at the start of this podcast, I know you're stretched pretty thin in your role, and I appreciate you freeing up the time. It was great to learn a little bit more about how you got to current state, and I appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate that.
You bet. All right, everybody, let's wrap up this episode right now. Remember, your intention matters. Why? Because as I say, that's the result you'll tend to get. We're out of here. We'll do it again next week, and let's go Leafs.
Yeah. We'll be right back.